Hi everyone, on this month's podcast we have with us Faith Odhiambo, who is the president of the LSK, the Law Society of Kenya. I'm delighted to have you here with me, Faith. Thank you so much for making the time. I know you're a very, very busy woman these days. Faith, first of all, thank you. You've been really the face protecting the protesters during what has been a very turbulent time for Kenya. How are you feeling?
Well, right now, I have the unease of what happens to a lot of the families, particularly those who are still looking for their loved ones that have disappeared, and we've not been able to get a trace of where they are.
Yeah.
So that gives me that unsettling feeling because, people expect that something must be done. The quagmire is that I don't have investigative powers or resources to be able to try and, you know, carry out a large-scale investigation to establish what happened, where are they. And so we still have that painful reminder that, you know, over 60 people have disappeared and we don't know what have happened to them.
So for those who don't know, the finance bill and the protests that started because of the finance bill is really the reason why people took to the streets, because they were unhappy about the bill and its enactment. And what resulted in, what started as peaceful protests resulted in a lot of people being arrested, abducted, taken into court, held and detained unlawfully. The Law Society and you and your other members really rallied for protection of the people who had been detained, because I guess you felt that this is your role. You didn't have to do it so vocally or publicly, but you did do it. And I think you represent for us a new face of Kenya, especially in the judiciary. What is your feeling about, first of all, how the people, how the protesters were treated, and second of all, your role in making sure that the law was abided by the police?
Well, let me just say that when the protest started around 18th June, that day was surprising for me,
mm-hmm.
because I'm used to seeing very young people complaining on social media, but they don't do anything but complain. And so it was a shock for me to see them actually saying that Ghana organizers are going to come to the streets. And, you know, I was with my council and I was like, what can we do?
Mm-hmm.
What really can we do to help them? Because we are still a profession and we still must maintain the standards set. And, you know, I also have quite a large number of young people, a lot of Gen Z advocates.
Yeah.
And so all of them wanted to join in the streets. So I told them, okay, wait, instead of joining to the streets, why don't we help by ensuring if they're arrested or anything happens, they'll have free legal representation. So in fact, that particular day when the protest started, I was attending a memorial mass at Makadara Courts on behalf of one of the magistrates that had been shot and killed on the line of duty. And so as we leave, I get a distress call from some of my younger members of the bar telling me that Central Police Station and some one of our members or two had been arrested, mm-hmm. alongside.
Who had been protesting?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they got to the police station, they realized so many other young people have been arrested.
Mm-hmm.
So when they are demanding to see them because they want to know why have they been arrested, the police were not agreeing.
Mm-hmm.
So I joined them there at the police station. And what happened is that the OCS wasn't there, but the police were totally unruly. And it's like the general status quo that might is right.
Mm-hmm.
You're not allowed to see the protesters. Well, these are criminals, and we're like, what is criminal? The law says this. And so there was a bit of a scuffle. And at the end of that particular period, when one of the OCPDs came, there was tear gassing of advocates, including
myself. In the police station?
In the police station.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of my council members was injured. And they insisted that they're locking the police station till evening, they're not seeing anyone.
Yeah.
So we came back at 6 p.m. and we said, you know what, we're going to camp. If you're not letting them go, we're going to count this from the time mm-hmm. you arrested them,
mm-hmm.
and we'll tell the courts you're legally holding them.
Because as as you've explained to me, you can only be detained for 24-hour period before you need to be released.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You need, our law provides that you have, they only have 24 hours to present you before court once you're arrested.
Okay.
So that if it's, unless they have given you a bail or released you, and I was wondering on what charges will you release somebody? They were just walking on the streets. They have not destroyed any property. They have not vandalized anything. And they were just walking with a bottle of water. They were not armed. They have not harmed anyone. And they're walking amongst their friends. Because if you saw the face of that protest, they were pretty much very, very young. Men and women. And, you know, they were just chanting songs, singing along, dancing on the streets. It was the most, one of the most thrilling demonstrations I've ever seen, because young people taking a stand for what they truly believe in. You know, the sometimes I say you don't see honest protests that are driven by true values. Someone driven by true conviction of an idealistic society. And those are things that most of us had stopped believing in, seeing how things work.
Yeah, definitely. For us as I guess what generation am I? Millennials.
Yeah.
We really did not grow up in an era where a protest was something that we could take part in or even believe in or even bother to do, because we didn't believe that there could be change. But this generation is really demonstrating that you can, through peaceful protest, demonstrate what your values are and what you want to achieve. I want to ask, so when all of those, the scuffle happened, you're talking to the OCPD, the police are acting as if they're a law unto themselves, as it were. What are you looking at? Are you arguing legal points? Are you just arguing? Are you telling them, give us the arrest sheet? They know
the law. Mm-hmm. It's the question of ignoring the law.
Yeah.
And they rely a lot on the fact that most people don't know their rights.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And so we knew that a majority of young people would just be arrested thinking that it's wrong because they have taken that defiant step to demonstrate. The police have the right to arrest them.
Yeah.
So I was telling them, show me the charges.
Yeah.
On what basis will you be taking them to court?
Mm-hmm.
So that we can bail them. You're saying that, we said the Chief Justice had given directions. These things are all bailable during Willy Mutunga's time.
Mm-hmm.
And like this, going to the street to protest, you feel they've done a crime, okay, charge them. Give us the bail or bond terms. Mm-hmm. We see their families, you know, because we had families, parents waiting outside for their children, a lot of them quite anxious. So like their parents are here to bail them. So you give terms.
Mm-hmm.
And so after a lot of push and pull, those years promises that he will write down everyone and he will now give bond. But at the end of the day, they released every single person. So we were sharing roles, even with the chair of Nairobi branch, between Central, where they had the majority. There were some arrested at Kamkunji, some at Milimani, very few. And so we are sharing roles, just spreading ourselves, who's in charge here, and then, mm-hmm. you know, just collating, are you successful? Are you having problems? Do I need to sift to the other side?
Yeah.
And so we're able to ensure that first day, every single person was released without any charge at all.
Mm-hmm.
And something that I really liked, even spaces like Kisumu on the second protest, the DPP there was quite strong and strict that they will not arrest.
Mm-hmm.
They'll not give approve any charges against someone for exercising their rights under Article 37,
mm-hmm.
right to protest and assembly. And so that was a good show of strength that the police now knew they, even if you arrest, you just have to release, mm-hmm. because at the end of the day, because even the second protest, what most of them were doing is just trying to delay and moving, shifting them from one police station to another. And so reality is, even saying that you're going for them, it's not that the police don't know the law. It's efforts to try and circumvent.
Yeah.
So you're trying to move from one police station to another. Some they deny are there, but when you insist, you say you're not leaving. And they know they can't now move them.
Okay, because they can't physically move them because you're there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, at the end of the day, they will now agree to release them. Mm-hmm. So those are the challenges we kept having. And soon thereafter, we would start getting very crazy charges, which I honestly believe some were quite trumped
what
up
kind
charges.
Of charges?
There was mugging.
Yeah.
They were all apparently destroying something like a huge group altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And even the footage or evidence that were there that doesn't make sense,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the aim as to how do you keep them in jail long enough to try and scare them or teach them a lesson.
Yeah.
And something amazing about these young men and women, because they'd be like, for us, we are young and we have nothing to lose.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing we fear is marriage and pregnancy. And so telling us that you'll keep us here, because I remember at Langata, we were trying to release one. She was a 16-year-old who had been arrested and she had joined the protest. And so we were trying to get her released and looking for her guardians, whoever, to come and pick her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the reality is that people, even if you see some protesting, it's the reality of the stark poverty that is there in the country, and people just fighting because they believe that they can make a difference. And I remember that young girl, her mother was like, she's not coming because she's not going to pay bail, and now she's working.
Mm-hmm.
And so if she decided to protest her, she doesn't have the money. So it's a lot of coaxing that the sister actually came to pick her up, and we had to, you know, negotiate for the terms and get it paid to get her out. But one young man made me happy because his parents came to pick him up, and we were trying to still negotiate to reduction of the bails,
yeah,
for everyone, and it was still a bit high to get everyone out. And as we're still looking who can help us fundraise, and the parents who are there, his parents came and paid.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he was being told to leave, and he's like, what about my friends? And they're like, no, unfortunately, you know, we have not been able to raise their amount, but your mom has paid for it. And they said, no, I'm not going.
I'll stay here.
I will stay here with them.
Gosh. And so the bail, how much was the bail ranging from? It was for, I guess, public disorder offenses.
Yeah. So it was between some, if we'd manage really well, 5,000,
yeah,
but most around 15,000-20,000. So
Gosh.
You can imagine that kind of amount looking to pay for, you know,
yeah,
50, 100 people. That's a crazy amount.
Mm.
So if they're not willing to give them then free bond terms. And that's why sometimes courts were better, because courts were a bit more reasonable,
mm-hmm,
in terms of bail and bond terms, at least in Nairobi.
Yeah.
Because I know later on they started fishing, trying to take people to Kajiado and other courts to just try and get, you know, high bail,
yeah,
and bond terms to get 100,000 plus, so
Gosh.
That it's difficult
for just a protest.
Yes. And you remember there was such an outcry in Naivasha,
yeah,
when children were given 100,000 bail terms, and of course LSK had to intervene to ask those orders,
yeah,
to be reviewed,
yeah,
at the High Court. But I think that is part and parcel of the greater impediment, that I know courts are independent, but they must also be alive to people exercising their rights.
Yeah.
And so either to handle and deal with the matters expeditiously, to not frustrate. Because when courts as well allow themselves to be weaponized in the criminal justice system, that you frustrate protesters. And you know, a way of frustrating is to ask for adjournments, keep coming to court. Because I know I have a lot of people who still call me,
yeah,
who we are still attending court for, and they're like, today my matter, I don't know where it is. We were like 50 or 80, and you know, others were called in this court, I wasn't called in this court.
Mm-hmm.
So you see those basic frustrations, and you don't know, and they also fear that if their matter is not called out, then warrants of arrest may issue.
Correct.
So mm-hmm, also those issues of the court's failure to align its system in terms of how do you ensure everyone gets a fair hearing, that they notify all the protesters in time, and these frustrations for matters to drag beyond without end is a way of weaponizing the courts in to frustrate people in the criminal justice system. So that next time, if you were dragged in court for a year or 2 years, you'll be thinking, do I really need...
And never will I go back to the streets again.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's so many things that we learned from those protests. So, for example, you're talking about the police and their powers, the way they treated the protesters. You're talking about the government system. You're talking about the judiciary itself and then, you know, the protesters and their right to demonstrate. The separation of powers in this country doesn't seem to be where it should be, where there's an independence of judgment and thought from the government trickling down to the judiciary and the police. And so how do we, knowing this, how are we going to deal with it going forward? What is your role in ensuring that there's a reform for the judiciary and for ensuring an independence of the police?
In terms of independence of the judiciary, I always say that it starts, responsibility starts at the top.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kind of practice directions that the Chief Justice gives and the kind of tone that she sets, particularly, I remember at the onset of the protest, she issued directions that courts should try and accommodate by sitting longer hours.
Yeah.
So I remember in Milimani, we were having court sessions running past midnight.
Yeah.
Because she issued those directions. So that made a difference. So we had clerks staying and various staff members to ensure bail and bail is processed, because another frustration, of course, would be the OCS of Central running away because he doesn't want to release them.
Mm.
But courts would then ensure that the matter is heard and determined. They issued the decision and help process any release documentation that you need, which really helped. However, I still wrote to the Chief Justice raising the concern that why can't protest matters be heard and determined within 6 months?
Yeah.
It gives somebody the opportunity to know what they're being charged. Mm-hmm. If I'm really have done something against the law, let my matter be heard and determined. Mm-hmm. By this allowing the prosecution to keep coming back and forth and saying we are still investigating, Phil, then you terminate the matter until you have actual evidence.
Instead of holding someone.
Mm-hmm. And so it was quite unfortunate that we still had to keep coming to court, you know, fighting off, you know, fishing expeditions.
Yeah.
You know, I find it so ridiculous when I'm a prosecutor is coming to tell the court that we are still trying to investigate, but in the meantime, we ask you to hold them further.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're telling the courts we are back in the Moi days, so let them be held in detention until we have something we can actually charge them.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why sometimes some of our courts don't see that language and don't hear that language. Because our same courts were the ones that during the Moi days were saying that the red phone, you know, they would be called by the red phone and they knew you had to follow these instructions. If they actually are fighting for independence, it's not about the citizens fighting for independence. You must also take responsibility.
Every single arm must take responsibility and be of independent. Their own
independence.
Yeah.
And so when you find yourself falling into that foray, you should sound the alarm.
Yeah.
I must say that there were some magistrates that really stood out for me, particularly when we attended court, we were the 180. The magistrate, so I forget her name, she read the riot act, particularly to the police officers from Central Police Station, those who had children for over 24 hours.
Yeah.
We had people fainting in court because they hadn't eaten anything. And she directed also judiciary give them something to at least drink.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that's first the face of humanity at our courts. And secondly, it's somebody who is alive and listening. That, and, you know, reading the riot act and telling the police, you know, once somebody's a child, their rights immediately accrue.
Yeah, exactly.
You must treat children differently.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we must have courts that, even as we say judicial independence, judicial activism, it shouldn't be just activism for the negative.
Mm.
They should actually be active in realizing the Constitution, because they are the bedrock of protecting the Constitution, protecting people's rights in this Constitution.
Yeah.
And so if also they do not take a hold of their own independence, because executive exerts itself and spreads its arms. Parliament as well spreads. You know, the judiciary must also take responsibility. It's not a question of just saying that, oh, our independence is being eroded. They must as well take responsibility and push back to be able to hold firm and tell the other arms of government that in this court, we are in charge.
Where do you think it all went wrong? Because I saw an interview that you had done where you talked about the failure of actual parliamentarians to begin with in being able to make independent decisions for their constituents who they're supposed to be representing. And that leading to the finance bill being passed without real interrogation. And then people complaining, the same constituents that they represent, and then taking to the streets. Where did we go wrong in this country in terms of electing people who don't necessarily have our best interests at heart?
Well, you know, the time that parliamentarians were not earning a lot of money, and apart from that, they relied, knowing that if I don't do the will of my people, I'm going to go out and the benefit in these 5 years will not be commensurate. But now we have made them sit pretty. We have the committees, them getting a lot of money in these various committees. Their salary is quite substantial. Then they have so many different funds that they're managing, the CDF. I had this one called Constituency Administrative Fund, amongst others. And so they have grown to be comfortable. Mm-hmm. We have members of parliament becoming rich overnight, owning choppers and things. So they feel, and even I saw one, she was talking about, I must be loyal to government because at the end of the day, in the 5 years, they will give me a lot of money to come back and pour to the people and they will vote for me back. And I'm like, first of all, we need to clip out some of these funds that they are benefiting and let it go back directly to the people. Let CDF go into some fund for free education for everyone. Some of this constituency administrative fund, why should they have it before they survived without it? So some of these monies that are being accrued and spent should go back to the constituencies. They benefit from the road levy, an amount that for development of the rural roads. Why can't we leave it solely for the national or the county government to be able to carry out development? Because what we end up having is members of parliament just engaging in war parts with their counties to create relevance for them to be able to vie. And then that money is not actually spent. Because if you look at some of our rural roads, they're still in a dilapidated state. And so our people still have this notion that the reason these roads are not made is because the executive does not come, the head of the executive does not come from my village, which is a fallacy. And so if we start having the institutions we have set being given proper funding and removing these small pockets that is shared and members of parliament determining who sits there, who gets those contracts, we cut out a lot of the corruption, we cut out a lot of the control. Then the only voice that they know that will be controlling them is the voice of their people. So if you're not standing there and listening to your people, then there's nothing much to benefit. And a lesson to us, to the people of Kenya as well, because power belongs to the people. And donate that power without making it transactional.
Yeah.
Because if they have to pay you for that power, then there's nothing else. I think we have to get to that level in a country that you can still take money and vote wisely. And so I wouldn't tell somebody who's struggling that don't take the money. I would like, if they come after the 5 years to give you money, collect all that money in any event.
It's your tax money.
Your money. So take that money with confidence, but vote wisely. It'll be a stronger, resounding message that you cannot buy us with your money. That you're either able to implement the policies that we want, or we will wait for the 5 years. We will collect from all of you, say sorry to ourselves for the tax money that you've spent wrongfully, but we will not vote you in.
We will not vote you in. So the protests happen. Obviously, you're very busy bailing out or, you know, releasing the protesters. The president then has this TV interview, which went very badly for him because I think it didn't show him in the best possible light. He then tries to assemble a task force, and you were called to that task force, and you refused to join. Why did you refuse to join it?
I refused to join the task force because constitutionally we were going to duplicate roles, and that was not our mandate. And so in any event, just by looking at what we're supposed to do, we're actually taking over roles that were not ours. And so even the courts vindicated and have held the same. Though not to, I don't think the matter has been heard and determined, but even at interim, the court issued conservatory orders. And my challenge with that, and just even looking at the time frame, like we wouldn't be able to achieve
what
was provided for. And we have a problem in this country of certain task forces, unless you're properly embedded on the law. What will happen is that you will spend taxpayers' money and then someone will go to court and disband, or it will be challenged and that becomes it. You know what happened to the Shakahola task force that was set. And you see, at the heart where people are actually calling for true accountability, there's no point of starting a process that you know will not get anywhere. And the people want real answers. The people want public participation, because even that task force, there's no public participation. You can actually carry about the public debt in 3 months and people will be able to know the truth and interrogate, and even the work set out to actually carry out the kind of the bonds that we've undertaken as a country, the 2 euro bonds, you know, that quagmire question, where did the money go? You know, those are things that needed quite a bit of work. And so there are two options: working with the Auditor General, because the private sector, she has the power to set up a similar committee. But apart from that, even if the private sector could have been empowered to carry out, they would have to carry out alongside the Auditor General, ought to have been part of that committee as well, because she has a history of what's happening, all the debt in the country. So she would have been able to guide that process so that we have a semblance of actually getting the truth out. And as independent civil society organizations, by our own right, would be able to raise alarm where we feel that things are not going well. But she has powers to exercise and demand for that information, powers that we don't have. And so for me, that was a backdrop, because the country is the height of accountability, and we are demanding transparency and people are demanding answers. And so I felt that it would be disingenuous to engage in that, yet we're not going to achieve that very purpose.
I mean, the thing about you, Faith, is that is really admirable. And, you know, it's the right thing to do. But do you feel that you're alone in doing the right thing? Because very few people, at least publicly, can be seen to be making those kind of judgments instead of, you know, enriching themselves. Do you feel alone?
That was an interesting, because everyone keeps asking that, Kenyans are used to taking, why didn't you take? Well, I would say that for that particular moment, particularly on that committee, I felt alone. In fact, I felt that I made the rest of them uneasy. Because of my decision.
You were the first person to say, I'm not doing this.
That particular time I felt, I thought this is the obvious thing to do. And I, of course, consulted with my council as well, and we made that decision as a council. So I was like, irrespective of being alone or making them uncomfortable, I said it's fine, because you see, this is also a collective decision that affects not only myself, but the Law Society of Kenya as a council, as a team. So I said, okay, at the end of the day, everyone has to make a decision that you have to stand by. So if they are comfortable and they can stand by this decision, so be it.
So we are 2 months or 3 months down the line from the time of the protests. People are still going to court because their hearings are happening or not happening, as you've just explained. What have we learned about this country? And is there any positive change that has come out of all of these protests? Are we done protesting?
Well, I'd say what we have learned as a country, first of all, is people have some renewed sense of strength that they still have the power and the power of public participation. I don't know what the Supreme Court is going to decide, but I hope that the courts do not take away the right of the people and the right of the people's direct voice.
Yeah.
The Constitution brought in public participation, which has been one of the most powerful tools to actually push back. Because facing a parliament that is an appendix of the executive, then you need sometimes the voice of the people, because the judiciary can only get involved when we challenge decisions made by either of the two arms. They cannot be an active voice to go and make decisions and go and heckle.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who you expect to be speaking loudly, shouting on behalf of the people in parliament, are not doing that.
Yeah.
And so public participation has become quite a powerful tool in just people exerting their power and their direct influence to make decisions in laws, in policy, and in their future. And so that renewed strength and seeing the power of the Gen Zs, because the Gen Zs were able to bring an intergenerational shift. We had millennials joining the protest. We had the X, the baby boomers, and the like. People coming to the streets, generation of a family, that Gen Z, a millennial, an X, your grandparents are there with you to walk with you on the streets. And it was quite admirable seeing parents meeting with their children, and some who were comfortable seeing mothers saying that, you know, our kids are being killed, we will go in the streets to protect them. And so for me, it was quite a moving moment in our country, because people are starting to realize responsibility of seeing the growth of the nation, responsibility of demanding for good governance, responsibility of asking hard questions belong to the people of Kenya. We have young people coming out and outspoken. We have some using media in terms of using comedy to satire and analyze what the government is doing. You know, things that were happening during KJ days, he's now in parliament singing a very different tune. But they used a lot of comedy to criticize. Now we are having young artists using comedy to criticize. We are using poetry, spoken word, song to criticize and analyze. I saw one interesting TikTok yesterday, just analyzing the conduct of, you know, the acting inspector general of police. And so people have not been silenced. In fact, they're saying we have just changed tact. We're now not on the streets, but we're going to still use our talents to be able to have our voice heard.
Yeah.
To raise our concerns in what is going good governance. We have people like Morara going around looking at government projects, the promises, how much was allocated.
Yes, I saw the one on the hospital and the amount that had been allocated and what the building looked like, and it was online and it went viral as well.
So people are criticizing now. People are taking action. So people are not just quiet. Citizens are raising now questions, because Kenyans, we used to have this habit of just forgetting. But now we have people who are helping Kenyans keep it at the fore. We can have more accountability. People can be investigated. People now can be arrested. Institutions that thought they were above the law, or that they could do whatever they want, withdraw cases, ignore hue and cry of the people, now the citizens are on that and telling them, you're investigating this thing, on what basis are you withdrawing? And so everyone is now under public scrutiny. Everyone is now facing the sword. Everyone is being asked hard questions. And so we see government also erasing the head of state's name for projects that have not been able to be completed or have failed. And so I see that's an impact. You've been able to ensure that also the head of state is monitoring who is doing what project that I kicked off. You must complete your projects.
Correct.
And money has been allocated. Where has that money gone?
Because they'll be asked those questions.
And so I say there has been a very strong impact. It's changed the mood of the people from quiet and lull to back to activism. Mm. People asking hard questions, even of the judiciary. No one now is above the law. Everyone is being scrutinized. Everyone is being asked hard questions. There's no opportunity for you to, you know, just sit and say, I will do this, and there's nothing that is going to happen.
Mm.
People have become tougher. And just seeing the impact that the Gen Z's has reignited even the older generations to say, you know, we still have a something we can do. There's a role that we can play. The country belongs to us.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's in the country's our interest. The country's our business. We must protect our country and ensure that it flourishes.
Well, definitely. I think you have done your part. And, you know, Faith, we really admire you and we really respect you. I personally feel very proud to be sitting next to you just to hear what you have to say as a young woman. It's very respectable. But let's talk about Faith herself. Who is Faith?
Faith is a mother. Faith is a teacher. Faith is a lawyer, commercial lawyer, corporate
and commercial. You just told me that you're a commercial lawyer. I mean, I'm a commercial lawyer as well. How do you balance now all of these, your role as LSK president, your role as the face of the country, the protesters, and then, you know, your practice, your family, how are you doing it?
And see, sometimes you don't really balance.
Mm.
I think my law firm has suffered the most. Thank God I have partners, because they've told me, okay, we've given you to LSK in the world for in Kenya for just these 2 years. Yeah. Then you come back and the managing partner will be like, how are your numbers?
The numbers.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So how much are you bringing in?
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that now it's sometimes during the protests, I really say I give LSK more in Kenya. But now things are coming down. I'm trying to go back to checking homework once in a while, pick and drop. As you try and balance with also the day-to-day, because demands have become much higher.
Ah, the kids, when they see you on TV, are they like, ah, that's mom?
No, my baby's still small. Okay. By that time, he should be asleep. You know, by 8 is bedtime.
Yeah.
So by that time, he shouldn't even be talking anything, because like sometimes I have meetings, I try to rush home, just, you know, check he's finished his homework, he's eaten. And then put him to bed. Once he sleeps, you can go back and continue working. Mm. But I would say that I've been blessed because I've had a supportive spouse. I know it's not easy for him to survive me, but particularly all that has been going on.
He must be very proud of you as well.
Yeah. But he's really supported as well, you know, because some of them very late night and we're alone. So I'm like, let's go together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he's braved some of the police stations with me, so people don't see because of a camera, but he's had to, you know, brave, because also, and I think people think you're superhuman, but you're like, you also, you know, it's late at night and what, so you're like, you need that sense of protection.
Mm-hmm.
So we have braved late nights, you know, those calls that come in, you're like, why are you picking calls? Mm. I'm like, it could be somebody is in need, because, you know, we'd get 3 a.m., 2 a.m. calls that if somebody's at my door, what do I do?
Yeah.
And so I'd say he's really, really survived. But my partners also at the law firm have been amazing, just trying to see how they can support.
Yeah.
Put in the work, and my counsel, because we've had to really spread ourselves thin, wherever I was been going, and all my branch members, because the protests were all around the country. So rallying people, you need a lot of support, rallying the branches to go out in Mombasa, in Eldoret, Kapsabet, Kericho, you know, Kisumu and environs. It was quite a bit of up and down. And I love the grace in which they picked up that responsibility. And, you know, they said, it's fine. We will keep liaising where they're stuck. They need me to call or they need my intervention. But they were everywhere. Yeah. You know, you'd hear Nanyuki, what is happening? We're following up Naivasha in Meru. And so you keep getting feedback from the chairs. We're doing this intervention. I would be like, I've seen this case. What is going on? There's no advocate. They'd rush there. And so the kind of support I've gotten from the legal profession has been quite amazing. I really laud them, because would not have been able to do this countrywide interventions. We had people in Voi, in Kilifi, you know, people were doing all they can. Everyone was carrying this baton. You know, someone is setting aside their own personal court matter and saying, you know, the president has asked me to do this, let me rush there. And so I'd say that the Gen Zs should know that the widespread around the country, the legal profession really tried and put themselves out there to just try and help and get and ensure that everyone was safe.
You didn't have a conventional route to law, and I think you said that you were disappointed that you didn't get into your preferred choice for university. You then went to Catholic University and studied law there. But really, it is a calling. Do you feel like you made the right decision and not you were supposed to do accounting or something like that?
Yeah, because that time Catholic just opened. I said Catholic was godsend. So I'm the very first cohort who studied at the Catholic University. So Catholic was godsend, like a university opens up and you get called. We apply and you get called. So Catholic was godsend for me because I got to live my dream of still being a lawyer. I still did, of course, those accounts my mom wanted. So I was a CPS quite early to just ensure we tick all those boxes. And also languages was her push. So I still did those. But for me, law was godsend for me. And I think they also understood and knew for me it was a passion. None of my parents were lawyers. And so when I insisted that that's really what I really wanted to do, so I don't regret it at all. I feel Catholic opened for me an opportunity and a door to be able
to live. And look where you are now. So now what is the future like? Are you thinking you'll stay in private practice? Are you looking to be more in the public, in you know, in the government? Because there is a place for effective change to be done by people like you. Do you feel that that's something that you want to do?
I say let's wait and see.
So is it a faithful president? Actual president?
For president, that's not where my sights are right now. You know, I still feel there's a lot more I have to learn. And I'm sure wherever life pushes me, I'll be able to still make an impact. Because even when I took on this role as LSK president, my vision was to try and make changes solely for the legal profession. And of course, whenever you help, particularly the kind of civic education and pro bono work that we do to the public, I didn't foresee that we'd be pushed towards this direction for standing for people. So wherever life pushes me next, I'm sure I will still be able to make an impact and a difference.
We'll be watching. And thank you so much, Faith. I really, really thank you for taking the time to speak to us. Thank you for your service. What can we do as members, as you know, as lawyers, to support and continue to, you know, to demonstrate that we are with you and with the LSK?
I'd say as lawyers, we've still been taking up quite a number of the victims, particularly those we saw at Kenyatta National Hospital. Some are now coming to the Law Society. So we're preparing a lot of compensation cases against the government for those. You know, some became totally disabled. They've lost hands, legs because of the gunshot wounds. The unfortunate painful part is that a lot who went for medical treatment, because you weren't awake, you find that the bullet was removed and the bullet has since disappeared. So families are not able to get that justice in terms of, you know, saying that this is a person who shot me. But we still want to seek for their compensation. So to that extent, as much as possible, lawyers were still willing to offer their free legal services. We want to do class actions on those particular matters, that at least the courts pronounce themselves with regards to those people who have lost limb, and also just keep fighting to create that awareness for the victims that have disappeared and those who have died, that they're just not forgotten. Because it's quite important that we as a country get to a place where we'll be carrying out demonstrations without police using live bullets, without police using rubber bullets, tear gas, so that people can be able to peacefully protest without destruction, because it is possible. But the kind of force that you met upon your people, they will naturally retaliate. People want to survive. So people can't just stand and watch you kill them. They will naturally defend themselves. And so it's a harder lesson that we need to do, and also as a legal profession, to support those who can in measures that we can strengthen. We can make proposals to the law with regards to how to strengthen the role of IPOA, so that IPOA can be a bit more independent in being able to carry out investigations, and even be able to, you know, table to the people before even offering to the director of public prosecution, so that we know cases that are being tabled for prosecutions and are not being prosecuted.
Yeah, yeah.
So that we get to a place that the police also know, and also the powers to summon and punish those who refuse to appear before IPOA. Because unless we strengthen those institutions...
Just tell us, what is IPOA for the people who don't know?
Independent policing oversight authority.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need them to have more teeth to be able to investigate, to ensure protection of those they're collecting evidence from, and to be able to cite and hold police officers accountable.
Because
if we don't have that, then people will lose total faith and feel that the only way is to retaliate and get my justice independent. Once people start getting their independent justice as a nation, then we lose it. And also the notion that, and how do we strengthen even further KNHCR and also IPOA? Because
yes, the Kenya National Human Rights Commission.
Mm-hmm. Because we need to be able to find a way that they can be able to demand footage to be able to help identify those who are not dressed in police uniform but are picking people up. So today is we still have the case of Bob Jagi, Aslan, and Jamil Longton that is coming up today. And even the refusal to attend court by the Inspector General of Police, they should be, you know, the highlight of how do we hold such people accountable. Mm. It's not just contempt, but they should be, when you fail to obey court orders.
Because he's failed to appear in court and he sent someone else in his stead.
It should be an indictment that you lose your office.
Correct.
If you fail to obey court orders, because it's quite ridiculous for him to be saying on national TV that obey court orders, yet he's been held for contempt by the High Court for failing to obey those court. So it should not be just simple of citing. It should be to the extent that they will lose their offices if they fail to uphold court orders.
And what about the police office? Are we also pursuing the police officers who were seen to be, you know, shooting bullets at protesters?
So we filed cases against some. The challenge that we still have is connecting those police to the bullets or shooting, because a lot of the bullets were confiscated. And if you remember, even a lot of bullies were found, but there are gunshot wounds, but there's no bullets.
Yeah,
I remember one family, we were prosecuting their case. Their daughter was shot while in the estate. And the police, the father says the police actually said this is government property.
Gosh.
And took the bullet.
And took the bullet.
So they don't have evidence to be able to table. So we need also how to hold hospitals accountable. They must not release any items that could possibly be used as evidence.
Mm.
We had scores, the journalist in Nakuru, who they even thought that what had shot out the bullet wound, they wanted to go into the operation room
to remove it.
To remove it. And until the media officers who are with her stand on the camera is when those officers left. And so to that extent of the kind of impunity, we need to also have stronger laws to put those police officers in check and in place. And that's why I've been saying, we don't, as a nation, we don't think it's about training. That we always hear international organizations coming to train our police. We are tired. That's not going to change conduct. What is going to change the conduct of our National Police Service is when people actually start losing their jobs. and being held in liable and accountable and find themselves behind bars, then we will have a chilling and stealing change in this country.
Gosh, we have a long way to go, but hey, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us. There's so much more that we could speak about in this session, but I really thank you for taking the time. Keep going, and we will continue to support you all the way. So thank you very much.
Thank you.